So glad you are all able to join us tonight. Welcome to our inaugural Freedom of Thought Dinner. I'm Alita Cass, Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Director of the Freedom of Thought Project. When we think about threats to freedom of thought, especially for those of us in the libertarian and conservative camps, it's easy to see the threats coming from the government. The dangers of agency overreach present significant threats to liberty, and of course, there's no better place for that discussion than the executive branch review. But lately, we might also have the sense that government overreach does not fully explain all the threats that we see to freedom of thought. Cancel culture is one example. The phenomenon is hard to define, but back of the envelope description is leveraging cultural and economic power to restrict the ideas that we can express and the social or cultural policies we can discuss. And unfortunately, this seems to be a dynamic that's playing out across our economic and cultural institutions. The Freedom of Thought Project is working to address this dynamic, focusing on four key sectors: our law schools and law firms, the technology sector, and the corporate world more broadly. We are working to track and document the scope of the problem, but also to consider the incentives at play. What's driving this erosion of our free speech values? How should the marketplace be operating to promote and defend free speech? And even to question the role of the state, not just as a threat, but perhaps also as a guarantor of liberty. When we say in the Federalist Society mission statement that the state exists to preserve freedom, what does that mean? These are essential questions. The freedoms of thought and conscience, of discussion and debate, are valuable in their own right, but they're also valuable means by which we preserve the other substantive freedoms, and by which we discuss and determine the rules we all live by. And this brings us to tonight's program on ESG as a question of public and private power. I'm going to turn this over to our moderator, longtime friend of the Federalist Society and DC Circuit Judge Greg Katsas, to introduce tonight's program and panelists. Only additional housekeeping note: the QR code for everyone who has registered for CLE to log in at the start of the program and log out. There's two sides, it's on your table. You want the smaller QR code for your CLE credit. And with that, turn it over to Judge Katsas.
Thank you. So our topic, is the mic on? Can you hear me? So our topic is the environment, social, and government ESG movement in the banking and investment sectors. And our sponsor is the FedSoc Freedom of Thought Project. So first, what is ESG? As I understand it, it is firms using social, not necessarily financial, considerations in order to make business decisions. So you have banks, for instance, falling all over themselves to commit to their own net zero emissions within their own operations. But more broadly than that, you have a big bank like JP Morgan committing to net zero in its lending portfolio. So think about what that means, right? Regardless of the investment risk from the lender, and regardless of the premium that they can extract from making the loan given the risk, they're taking the position that if the company emits too much carbon for their view, JP Morgan won't lend them any money. Likewise, for institutional investors like BlackRock, they will refuse to invest in firms that don't toe the BlackRock line on everything from environmental goals to racial preferences in hiring, ranging from entry level to board appointments. So why might we think this is a problem? Well, one obvious concern is these folks are acting to achieve public, government-like ends, but without either the government expertise or the checks and balances that would apply if they were government actors. We might or might not have confidence in the EPA to assess climate change, but do we really have confidence in the CEOs of JP Morgan or BlackRock? And as for checks and balances, if EPA wanted to impose net zero emissions on broad swaths of the American economy, they would have to do a rulemaking. They would have to take comments. They would have to follow all the APA procedures. They would have to produce a record supported by substantial evidence. They would have to give a reasoned decision. And they would have to come into the DC Circuit and face judicial review. None of that applies to even the largest of firms, which, although dominant, are still private. Second concern is, are these groups acting in the interests of their shareholders? You might think there are still some shareholders left who actually want to maximize the return on their investment, which until a couple of years ago was the widely accepted goal of corporate enterprise. There was always, even in the old rules, there was always an agency problem of how, if you're just some poor small shareholder, how do you control the management of your company? Even in the world where everyone agrees the manager of the company is supposed to try to make money for the shareholders. So how much harder does that get when now there's no longer any agreement? You own shares in BlackRock, and they might or might not have as their top priority making money for you. Or how much harder does it get to control if you own shares in a company, and the CEO says to you, I don't really want to tilt at windmills, but I have to or else I can't get the loan. Third issue is whether or not there are realistic alternatives. One obvious conservative answer to all this is just the market at work and what's wrong with that. Strikes me here the question might be just a very old-fashioned question about market power. In the banking industry, it seems like there are five or six banks who are dominant. And in the institutional investment sector, situation's even worse. The dominant firm, BlackRock, has, if my figures are right, at least 5% in 97% of the S&P 500. And the three leading firms pushing all this ESG stuff collectively own one-third of all public equity. What's the connection to the Freedom of Thought project? This doesn't quite involve literal suppression of speech or thought the way one sees on law school campuses these days. But the phenomenon here seems similar in a lot of ways to something that Alita and I looked at last summer doing the rollout project, the rollout series of panels for Freedom of Thought on the issues raised by big tech. And it seems similar. You have dominant firms, think Facebook, Twitter on the one hand, or BlackRock or JP Morgan here, who are leveraging their market power in whatever market they dominate in order to achieve social and political objectives. Facebook and Twitter, it's suppressing speech that they find ideologically objectionable, and BlackRock and company is imposing all these private environmental policies, and doing so outside the constraints that would apply if they were treated as government actors subject to, in the case of big tech, the First Amendment, in the case of these financial firms, the APA. So that raises the questions that our panelists will address on whether this is something we should take seriously despite the private nature of the actors, and what if anything, can be done to maximize both the prosperity for American investors and the political accountability of the folks who want to impose these standards. We've got a great panel to address these issues. Let me now introduce them. Matt Stoller is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. Previously, he was a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, and he worked in the House of Representatives on financial services policy, including on the Dodd-Frank statute and the foreclosure crisis. Matt has written articles for the New York Times, the Washington Post, New Republic, and Salon, and he was a producer for the Dylan Radigan Show on MSNBC. Currently, he's writing a book on monopoly power in the 20th century. Julia Mahoney is the John S. Battle Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law, where she teaches courses in constitutional law, property, government finance, and nonprofit organizations. She's also taught at the USC Law School and at the University of Chicago Law School. Her scholarly work includes articles on eminent domain, regulatory takings, land preservation, healthcare reform, and property rights in human biological materials. Christina Skinner teaches law and business at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She's an expert in financial regulation, central banking, debt markets, and corporate governance. Her scholarship has been published in several leading academic journals, and she's contributed to working groups convened by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Financial Stability Board, and the United Kingdom Banking Standards Board. Before joining the faculty at Wharton, she served as legal counsel for the Bank of England and as a visiting faculty at Oxford University and the London School of Economics. Our last speaker needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway. Ambassador Boyden Gray is the founding partner of the law firm Boyden Gray and Associates. He worked in the White House for 12 years, first as counsel to the vice president in the Reagan administration, and then as White House counsel to President George H.W. Bush. Boyden drafted the executive order requiring cost-benefit analysis and White House review of proposed agency rules, and he was instrumental in the enactment of the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, the Energy Policy Act of 1992, and a cap-and-trade system for acid rain emissions. Under President George W. Bush, Boyden served as the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. We'll start with opening statements from our panelists, so I will turn the floor over to Matt.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is this? Okay. Thank you so much, and it is an honor to be here and to speak to you. So I am a populist on the left, and what I think about a lot is antitrust and market power. So I want to offer a historical narrative about the role of the state in shaping social structures and how corporations and financial actors fit into that role. Essentially, I want to ask the question, and it applies to BlackRock just as it applies to Facebook or Google, how did we come to a situation where private actors, dominant actors, are making core social choices over investment capital and culture? So antitrust and dominant market power, consolidated passive investing that facilitates ESG are, in my view, adjacent spaces because they both depend on the consolidation of economic power. Big tech in many ways structures public discourse. BlackRock holds a huge share in lots of different corporations. In 2020, my organization released a report called The New Money Trust, how large money managers control our economy, what we can do about it. And this was about BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. And it's about their power, their market power. And it's about the same relationship that Wall Street and monopolists have since Brandeis wrote Other People's Money in 1914. So ESG investors and people like Larry Fink at BlackRock have a significant impact on corporate behavior in a number of areas. The hot button ones being questions of diversity and allocations of capital in the energy sector and carbon emissions in general. These individuals work through what one can call parastate institutions, which are designed to foster social goals without having to go through a public constitutional order. Now, the reason I want to offer a history is to address one current critique of ESG and stakeholder capitalism in general, that it is untethered from the ostensibly more neutral purpose of the corporation to benefit shareholders, which is a purpose crafted or articulated by Milton Friedman and then later Michael Jensen. And my view is that ESG is actually built on top of the Friedman-Jensen model and not in opposition to it. So while there is a moral argument to the stakeholder capitalism movement, to ESG investing, it is not that it is important to sacrifice profits for social goals.
So indeed, Larry Fink does not believe his actions come at a cost to shareholders, but that in fact social choices are in service of long-term profit and better returns overall. Fink simply believes that he is, as FDR might have put it, part of the informal private government of the United States. Now, Mark Zuckerberg isn't an ESG guy, although Facebook has committed to some of those same goals. But he has the best quote on how to think about the problem of private governments. He said a little over 10 years ago, quote, "In a lot of ways, Facebook is more like a government than a traditional company. We have this large community of people, and more than other technology companies, we're really setting policies." He was describing why he hired Sheryl Sandberg and emphasizing how important her experience at the Treasury Department was when he said this. He wanted a government official to help run Facebook. So that's not so far from the idea of ESG investment and the idea behind advocacy groups who take advantage of this movement like Just Capital. In The Lost Promise of Progressivism, historian Eldon Eisenach traces the rise of corporate America as part of an attempt, the original progressive movement, from whom I would argue both political parties emerge in the late 19th century, to create a national administrative apparatus without having to bother with politics, which they considered a reactionary redoubt of corrupt party bosses and a racist South. They wanted to replace political parties. The political party system in the 19th century was immensely strong. And they wanted to replace them with parastate institutions, universities, corporations, popular magazines and the mass media, foundations, high finance, nonprofits, labor unions, as well as an administrative state. And their moral guidance, which had come from the clergy, would be supplied by a new social scientific profession, most notably economists. So key to this movement was the idea of efficiency and the language of economics. It was a movement of moral reformers, religious moral reformers. So at the founding meeting of the American Economic Association in 1885, almost half the attendees were Protestant clergymen. And these progressives sought to elevate social science above parties, above politics, above lawyers, and above the Constitution, which they saw, again, as an anachronistic document protecting a reactionary South and West. So Herbert Croly, the founder of the New Republic, rejected the law itself as, quote, "bondage to a mechanical conception of social causation. The overthrow of the two-party system," he said, "is indispensable to the success of progressive democracy, because under American conditions, the vitality of the two-party system has been purchased at the expense of administrative independence and efficiency." So this original progressive movement built and strengthened many core nationalizing institutions, but they did not win the political fight. Instead, their opponents, populists, created an administrative state run by lawyers to tame high finance and the monopolists, these nationalizing administrative institutions, to break what FDR thought of was an informal government of the United States. So fear of corporations, of private governments, was pervasive among key factions of New Dealers, not the socialist faction, but the Brandeisian faction. And these populist figures largely came from areas today that are Republican red states and still carry that suspicion of concentrated power. It's largely, not entirely, but rural. So Wyoming Senator Joseph O'Mahony in the 1930s said, "Many of the modern corporations engaged in interstate commerce are greater and more powerful than most of our sovereign states." This fear was pervasive among conservative intellectuals like Henry Simons and Friedrich Hayek. But though progressives failed, the ultimate goal of the progressive movement, to place parastate institutions beyond the reach of lawyers and politicians, lived on in the form of several different movements. The first was the socialist-oriented consumer rights movement. So this sort of came from New Dealers who had fought to fuse the state and corporations together in the form of the National Recovery Act. But they lost the fight over FDR's agenda when Roosevelt turned out to be more of an anti-monopolist than a socialist planner. In 1952, one of these from that faction, progressive economist John Kenneth Galbraith, laid out in a book his view on how corporate America worked. This is a bestseller called American Capitalism. If you've ever read Galbraith, he's a beautiful writer. But he thought he was a fan of monopoly. Quote, "There must be some element of a monopoly in an industry if it is to be progressive," he said. He also attacked small business as self-exploitation. Along with Richard Hofstadter, C. Wright Mills, Richard Bell, and a host of thinkers, this group of intellectuals, they formed the economic worldview of the counterculture, and they erased the traditional populist disdain for technocracy. and they encouraged consolidation to pursue social goals. So this manifested in the consumer rights movement with its emphasis on technocratic elites, and their political progeny, such as Bill Clinton, won the political battle in the 1970s, and much of the modern Democratic Party is still enthralled to these ideas. The second group were the Chicago Schoolers, Aaron Director, Milton Friedman, George Stigler, and Robert Bork, some of the founding spirit of this society. Now, after breaking from Simons and Hayek, these men, though they despised Galbraith, ratified the ideological goal of elevating dominant firms above legal accountability. The basis of their vision was that efficiency in the form of economics was necessary to depoliticize the populistic New Deal state. They developed the regulatory and antitrust tools to unleash a financialized set of parastate institutions, global in nature, that cannot be tamed by elections, by an administrative apparatus, or the law. To them, the key goal was to have moral reformers in the form of economists dictate that efficiency was paramount, and to instrumentalize this vision through a legal framework that elevated these parastate institutions above republicanism, local communities, the church, even the family. And similar to the Galbraithians, this group built the counterculture-oriented view, but for the new right. So in the 1980s, the Chicago Schoolers engineered the Reagan Revolution. In the 1990s onward, the left, in the form of Bill Clinton, globalized it. One could pick many successes of these two sort of conjoined movements, from the relaxation of merger standards to the end of Glass-Steagall, but perhaps the apogee of this movement was Citizens United, which enshrined corporate free speech in the constitutional order itself. Another success was the Bush-Obama bailouts, which lifted up the property rights of dominant financiers over everyone else, paved the way for firms like BlackRock and JP Morgan. Similarly, the rise of big tech, firms like Disney, as well as the passive asset managers we're talking about, were facilitated by lax enforcement and the evisceration of antitrust law and financial regulation. So the fusion of these two movements, the Galbraithians and the Chicago Schoolers, meant the effective neutering of the administrative state, of checks and balances on these other parastate institutions, and the elevation of economics over law and Republican values. So that's what we're dealing with today. A faction within the Democrats is eager to exploit parastate institutions for social goals, getting around the existing electoral and political channels. Meanwhile, a significant part of the Republican establishment has built their politics around protecting these private parastate institutions from the actions of a democratic state. And both groups have a culture of deference to economists, who are the key moral reformers that use the language of efficiency. But there is deep rage at this state of affairs, and in both parties, new populist factions have emerged to challenge the bipartisan consensus in favor of deference to economists and dominant firms, financial actors, and men like Mark Zuckerberg. As both the right and the left grapple with these large parastate institutions wielding power over our social choices, this is a history that they will have to address. One cannot avoid the fundamental problem that the traditional post-1980 methods of governing simply cannot address the problem of dominant firms wielding social powers in ways that lack democratic legitimacy. Asserting that a firm is pursuing the wrong social goals, that it's too woke, or won't allocate capital in a particularly preferable way, or isn't censoring the right people, however you want to do it, that's not going to cut it. Not as long as the language of efficiency and the language of technocratic economics remains how we organize policymaking. Instead, we must have a genuine rethink of the moral and institutional basis of the relationship of these parastate institutions with the democratic state itself.
Julia, you're up.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Katsas. And thanks to the Federalist Society for putting together this program as part of its Freedom of Thought project and for including me. In his remarks just now, Matt Stoller referred to the widespread anxieties about the reach of private power throughout the 20th century in the United States, extending into our own age, the early 21st century. These sorts of anxieties, I think it bears emphasis, have been with us for our entire history as a nation. Members of the founding generation were keenly attuned to the dangers of excessive private power and its potentially corrosive effect on the res publica, the public good. And thus, the founding generation recognized the importance of designing institutions to restrain government grants of monopolies and restrictive corporate charters. as well as to constrain other government actions that promote the private interests of those with economic and political power to the potential detriment of the overall public welfare. This brings me to the subject of this evening's Freedom of Thought event, public and private regulation. What's driving ESG? In 1934, in the wake of the 1929 stock market crash and in the midst of the ensuing Great Depression, Congress created the Securities and Exchange Commission. In the SEC's own account, as articulated on its website, our country decided that for capitalism to flourish, we needed to protect investors from fraud and unfair sales practices. To fulfill its congressional mandate of protecting investors, maintaining fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitating capital formation, the SEC is empowered to require disclosures when such disclosures are necessary or appropriate in the public interest or for the protection of investors. The SEC came fairly quickly to be regarded as a successful independent agency. The SEC achieved this enviable reputation by instituting and maintaining a regulatory framework that focuses on the disclosure of material risks to the businesses of companies with publicly traded securities. This disclosure system has had the objective of putting ordinary investors, retail investors, on a nearly equal informational footing with larger and more powerful and better connected investors. And by doing this, the SEC, over decades, has promoted public trust in the financial markets. This has assured approximately 160 million individual investors, yes, that's how many we have today, who understand that they cannot fend for themselves in the financial markets, that they can invest their savings in markets that are fairly fair, markets that are not rigged in favor of market professionals and other powerful entities. On March 21st of this year, the SEC released a proposal to impose extensive and mandatory climate-related disclosure rules on publicly traded companies. It makes sense to ask whether these proposed disclosure requirements are in the public interest or will protect investors. In defending the SEC's proposal, the SEC commissioners who support it often point to investor demand. Investor demand, they say, is high for the information that the proposal requires public companies to disclose. Yet, the investor demand invoked to justify the SEC's proposal appears not to be coming from regular Main Street investors. The SEC's own proposing release has very little, surprisingly little, about retail investors. It almost never mentions them, in fact. Rather, the SEC's proposing release refers to the demands articulated by a group of large institutional investors, together with a number of prominent environmental organizations. The SEC's seeming lack of interest in the views of Main Street investors, what do they want? Are they not getting enough information? Do they want more? This is somehow not addressed, at least not head on. And the seeming lack of interest in the views of Main Street investors raises hard questions about the financial relevance of the SEC's proposed climate disclosures. This point is very important, for it goes to the heart of potential conflicts of interest between asset managers and ordinary investors. With respect to disclosures that bear directly on the financial performance of publicly traded companies, we can, in general, safely conclude that the interests of asset managers and their beneficiaries are fairly closely aligned. But the further we get from direct financial relevance, the less confident we can be that there is little or no conflict of interest. Now, is this divergence of interest merely hypothetical? No. There is a clear benefit to the financial interests of many of the institutions that are clamoring for the climate-related disclosures that the SEC is now proposing. Why? Well, bear in mind, just for starters, that a large chunk of the assets managed by the most prominent asset managers are in index funds. Index funds do not claim that their investment strategy is going to outperform the market. The strategy of holding the market rather than trying to beat it reduces costs, but it makes it impossible to divest from companies that are out of favor with any segment of the investing public. So to attract environmentally conscious investors, these funds need a new strategy. And it appears that they have hit upon one. They will press every company in their portfolio to become more green. Even if this destroys value overall, that is not a first-order problem for those who run index funds, because, of course, these index funds promise only to match the market return, whatever that market return may be. However, greening their portfolio requires a lot of information, and the funds don't want to pay for such information. It's very expensive. Enter the SEC. If the SEC can require companies, reporting companies, to provide extensive climate-related information, the asset managers can benefit. We've entered, in short, a very peculiar world, one where the SEC appears poised to help a small group of private asset managers to brand themselves, and brand themselves, it appears, at the expense of their own investors. A system of mandatory climate disclosures can also make life easier for executives at asset management firms. It gives them a cheap way to pursue social goals widely shared by their top officers and employees, once again at, quite possibly, the expense of the Main Street investors who have entrusted their savings to them. And just one more point before I wrap up. These disclosure requirements, if imposed, will, as mentioned, be costly. And this could lead to public companies deciding that they don't want to be public companies anymore, to go private, meaning fewer investment opportunities for Main Street investors who don't have access to investments in closely held enterprises the way that the rich and powerful and well-connected do. Now, it is not at all clear to me that the SEC commissioners and others who support these mandatory disclosure requirements have completely thought this through. I realize that public discussion is simply beginning. But it is striking to me how the discussion over these proposed mandatory rules, echoes so many themes that we have seen throughout history. And with that, I will stop. Thank you.
Christina.
Thank you, Judge. Good evening, everyone. So I'm going to use the language of efficiency quite a bit to juxtapose public and private power in the context of ESG. And in particular, in my prepared remarks today, I want to shine renewed light on the value of and the success stories of free market forces in the context of ESG. And to do that, I want to focus on various distortions that I see currently arising from ongoing experimentation with what looks and feels a lot like a command and control approach that really seeks to override free markets in this particular space. Society may well be understandably concerned with issues concerning the environment and climate change. There are some difficult and important questions that we need to wrestle with. But we must preserve the intellectual and policy space to reject the narrative that the only way to care about the environment as a facet of economic life in a morally cogent way is to endorse a government-led approach, especially where finance and markets are concerned. So in that vein, I want to suggest that it's a good time to remind ourselves of some very basic principles surrounding economic freedom and individual economic rights, to reflect on reasons why the executive branch's current approach to climate issues in particular is quite likely inefficient and possibly ineffective. And we have, as a society, have not yet sufficiently and openly debated whether in our journey to cleaner energy and energy security, we should be turning to governmental institutions and the command and control tactics of fiat and regulation, or to capitalist institutions that are led by market forces. Which set of principles and institutions will get us where we want to go as a society faster, cheaper, more adroitly, and with greater democratic legitimacy? Right now, in fact, we see a natural experiment unfolding in the climate and environmental space specifically. Both the government and markets are proceeding ahead at full steam. So from the get-go, the pronounced focus of the Biden administration, a pronounced focus, was climate change and environmental sustainability issues. President Biden made it clear that he expected a whole-of-government approach to tackling climate change and that financial regulators in particular would be front and center. Through the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the president directed the financial regulatory agencies, even those that should be formally independent of the presidency, to consider how climate change should be factoring into all of their various policies and procedures. Now, reading between the lines, the president ordered the financial regulators to think about how to advance the administration's goals on this front through the use of their regulatory and supervisory tools. But the private sector, at the same time, has also been running toward a net zero direction. We've heard a bit from Professor Mahoney about activity in funds, for better or for worse. And banks have also been using their debt-related tools on this front. So over the past 2 years, for example, all of the major U.S. banks have made very grand climate pledges, committing to going to net zero by 2050, to re-examining their portfolios in order to make them on the whole greener in the coming years, to rethinking underwriting practices to address climate as a form of credit risk, and possibly even rethinking their borrowing terms to incentivize certain green initiatives in borrowers or to penalize brown ones. Yet bank regulators and supervisors still have their foot on the gas. As a result, many of these private sector actions have a lot of noise behind them. Are these, in fact, rational reactions to basic forces of supply and demand of credit and perceived credit risk? Are they best efforts to fulfill the manager's fiduciary duties to shareholders? Or some proportion of banks' private climate governance driven by the need to get ahead of regulation or to satisfy some very loud public voices? Arguably, this top-down approach has and will continue to create various market distortions that may well ultimately fail to efficiently address society's interest in transitioning to a greener way of living. A fundamental tenet of liberal, small l, economic policy is that the government should not intervene when there is a private sector option and a viable solution in the private sector. So in this context, I think that principle carries the day both in theory and in application. And I want to give you three reasons why capitalism, that is free decision-making by financial firms, may be much more likely to lead to socially optimal outcomes than a command and control approach. So first, consider the very basic ideas of incentives and specialization. Banks, like other corporations, are profit-maximizing institutions. Now, this notion has been called into question, even maligned of late, But incentives and social interest are probably mutually reinforcing in the context of the environment and climate goals. Banks are highly incentivized to lend to the most profitable ventures, and in the case of universal banks, to provide advisory and underwriting services to companies likely to be successful to boost profits and reputation. So while banks do not have a comparative advantage in developing green technology, for example, they do specialize in lending to enterprises that have economic promise because they're likely to work. In other words, banks' business model will drive them to identify promising green technologies, to get those technologies to market, and to bring them to global scale. They don't need the government to tell them to do this. And this is precisely why banks were the catalysts and economic drivers of past industrial transformations in the 19th century in the US and Europe. And those historic events have been well documented by financial and economic historians. These prior rounds of structural transformation in the economy predated massive administrative states. Ford didn't develop a Model T because regulators pushed banks to lend to him, but because banks already knew that cars for the masses would be profitable. Acting on incentives to maximize wealth can, in many cases such as these, also be social welfare maximizing. Second point here is that equilibriums may arrive much faster in a market-oriented regime than a command and control one. Regulation can, in our modern government, come on very quickly. We now live in an era of presidentially driven regulation, regulation through enforcement priorities, supervisory guidance, appointments, and the like. Even formal notice and comment rulemaking is often a one-way ratchet, and we all know the public choice reasons why this is. Market forces can be much nimbler. Again, consider how this is playing out in the banks and climate governance space. The push by banks into the climate space also has raised some very legitimate questions. Were and are CEOs neglecting shareholders' property rights and interest in their shares by offering to sacrifice their profits to appease the public and regulators, neither of these latter institutions being the actual owners of the firm? Are bank CEOs using their corporate resources for personal political gain? And by redirecting capital flows in the economy, are these bank managers effectively making choices for society about which enterprises get capital to thrive and which do not, without any elected position and therefore no accountability to the people in society? But we may now see some signs of recalibration. Only recently, shareholders at Citigroup, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo voted down proposals to curb lending to fossil fuel projects, perhaps in recognition that transition fuels will be needed for at least another decade to come. If market forces can play out and the corporate leaders serve their shareholders' best interest, some equilibrium will be reached in the amount of resources the firm deploys toward the E in ESG. Now, third, the government seems not to be nearly as good at accurately and therefore efficiently allocating capital as the markets are where it comes to green energy technology and enterprises. So mandates for battery-operated or electric cars or to build wind turbines before they're commercially viable require subsidies. That economic policy in turn raises the question of whether we're spending billions of taxpayer dollars on infrastructure and hard assets that are not market ready at the cost of squeezing out research and spending that could create market solutions that would roll out to get us to green outcomes faster. Now, I'm not going to focus too much on specific technical analysis, but it's worth mentioning that there is some debate about whether the current iteration of green infrastructure that's being subsidized is in fact an improvement when full life use metrics are included, like the energy cost and consequences of mining for rare minerals. The crux of the inefficiency is that top-down approaches are unlikely to reckon with trade-offs to the extent a purely market-oriented endeavor necessarily does. If a business is required to build a plant that has to be paid back over 10 years, the owners and managers of that business will care about certain trade-offs and the need to address real resource constraints, like long-term supplies and supply chains. But if the state pays for most of the upfront costs of a factory, owners and managers care much less about these real constraints. In the end, society may well be left with orphaned assets and investments. the bridges to nowhere, and significant environmental waste. What happens to all of the lithium batteries and inefficient solar panels when version 2.0 comes out? Top-down approaches are very sticky. We need to ask whether a top-down approach is agile enough to account for and adjust to shifting facts and evolving situations. Just consider that several ESG funds were heavily invested in Russian firms, including oil and gas, but by virtue of our ratings paradigm, were judged more ESG friendly than Exxon. Those states in the Northeast that put limit on natural gas pipelines have in turn reinforced reliance on coal. In the EU, natural gas is now considered green as a transition source. So these are the types of entrenched distortions we can expect to flow from state planning style economic policy. And ultimately, society needs to more fully understand and debate what happens when you deprive individual economic actors of choice in markets. The outcome does not seem likely to leave society more prosperous or greener than if we allowed greater freedom in markets to address these environmental issues. Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador.
Yes, thank you, Judge. I appreciate your introduction, but you missed one thing. I was, in addition to being ambassador to the EU, I was also special envoy to the EU for Eurasian energy.
Stand corrected.
This is something which was very special. There are no special envoys in Belgium, usually. In that capacity, I was invited on my last day in Brussels to a dinner by the commanding general of the European Defense Force. I couldn't go because it was my last night, but I was surprised there was a general with that title, since there is no European Defense Force, other than NATO, of course. But he sent me a list of the invitees, and I was listed as Seaborne Gray U.S. Special Convoy. So I do know something about transportation and am therefore qualified to talk about it. And I agree with Christina that there's a lot of hidden carbon in the supply side of electric cars, which is not included, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. But let me first say that in terms of ESG, the Troika, as I call BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, they do own what you say they own. It might surprise you to know that they, right now anyway, own or are the largest shareholder in Twitter, own 18%. That's not going to last long, but it's what it is at the moment. I don't know what ESG really is. I think it's focused on the environment, frankly, and I'll get to that very quickly. I wonder whether BlackRock, which was pushing divestment of fossil fuels and investment in green fuels or green infrastructure, whether they have any liability for the fact that after pushing this very, very hard in their letters to stockholders, and his letter to stockholders, whether with oil and gas shares going through the roof after the war started, he should have better spent his time asking for disclosure of war-related investments. I mean, I think that would have been more proper. But does he have? Is there any liability for leading people away from a company like Devon Energy, which bought Mitchell Energy, which developed hydraulic fracking? Whether there was some problem here with Devon being the biggest gainer in the S&P for the last 2 years? It's an oil company, gas company based in Oklahoma. I don't know the answer to those questions, but I do think there is a conflict, moral probably more than legal, with BlackRock's huge investment in China. And if you're not using fossil fuels, you're having to invest in China to produce the windmills and the solar panels. So I think that's a conflict, maybe not legal, but certainly economic. What's the point of all this? Well, I think, as has been stated by the panelists here, the point is, by and large, environmental. There are also diversity concerns, but they tend to relate to issues revolving around preferences of various sorts that are very well covered by existing statutory law and usually banned. So it's really the environment. And there, the Supreme Court has said, and this is what Congress has done up till now, that the EPA has basically exclusive jurisdiction over, not against the private sector, but against other government entities, exclusive jurisdiction over climate change. So I don't know where the SEC fits in, or the Fed, or the OCC, or the FDIC, or any of the other regulatory agencies, whole of government approach. That's not what Congress has done. Now, Congress could change its mind and do that, but it hasn't. And what it's done is put EPA in the driver's seat. And the EPA has not been doing nothing. It's been doing quite a bit. And the emissions that are at issue here fall into two basic buckets. One is transportation, U.S. Special Convoy, which is the larger of the two, and the other is stationary, mostly utilities. As for the ultimate goal, what EPA lacks is the authority to do what Congress did in 1990, which is create a market to allow the marketplace to decide how these reductions should be achieved by looking for, financially looking for, the cheapest cost per ton reduced. Now, Congress has got to do that. But take transportation. Congress has actually sort of already done it. The CAFE rules and the EPA rules governing transportation are basically a trading regime. You trade credits back and forth. People probably don't know this. Most people don't. But Tesla didn't really turn a real profit on sales of its cars, per se, until this last year. Most of their money, billions, have come from trading their clean credits to the other car companies, and that's where their money's come from. But that there is a trading regime. Now, the problem with it is that they don't do life cycle analysis, which would smoke out the problems you very expertly pointed out, which would really do the trick, I think. They don't have that. And as a result, the thumb is on the scale of electric cars, which are heavily subsidized. There is a recent study by the University of Illinois saying that if internal combustion engines had the quality of fuel, which EPA is not permitting at the moment, but EPA could easily permit it, has authority to, then you would see, I think, a good fair fight. The Illinois study said that probably the life cycle of a properly fueled internal combustion engine today would have a lower carbon profile than an electric car. That's sort of interesting. But we don't know that because EPA is sort of blocking the development of the market that Congress has already set up. As for stationary sources, there is already EPA coverage, regulation of one sort or another, for nearly 90% of all stationary source emissions. That might surprise you. Most emissions come from very large sources which are subject to EPA attention. And it's not too hard to imagine EPA's capacity to deal with a relatively small number of very large emitters. It's a waste of time and a waste of money and probably totally illusory to try to go after the last 10%. That's always the most expensive, and why bother? You got most of it anyway. What's needed is a true market so that you don't have bureaucrats figuring out what the cost of carbon is, what's the cost of carbon. What you have is a marketplace that would set, Congress would have to do it probably, set what percentage reduction do you want by what year, and then let the private sector duke it out. When this happened in the 1990 amendments with acid rain, which has gone from 18 million tons at that time down to about 2 million today, it was very, very successful, and I dealt with a lot of CEOs in the utility industry 5 years after the Clean Air Act was passed, and almost to a man, they didn't know that there was a carbon trading system because it never caused enough difficulty, friction in the company to come to their attention. So it's an incredibly efficient way of doing it and fair way of doing it. And I hope that that is what will happen. But just sum up very quickly again, these other agencies really don't have the jurisdiction, and Congress has a big role to play. And one of the issues that's standing in the way, of course, is permitting. And the current administration has reversed all of the reforms that Trump put in to make building infrastructure possible. You may recollect that for the first infrastructure effort by Obama, he promised all kinds of things, but there weren't any shovel-ready projects. And the same thing is going to happen here. There aren't any shovel-ready projects. So permitting's got to be cut back and then a market installed, and then I think we'll probably be okay. And I think it is the last word before I depart, is I think that that there are legislative solutions, potential. There's bipartisan discussion now in Congress about a legislative solution to the power that the Troika have. And I don't think it's just because there are three of them that they're immune to antitrust. When the banks started pressuring the oil companies not to invest or promising not to finance them, that was a difficult period. And I can remember Squawk Box, CNBC Squawk Box, confronting Larry Fink about the antitrust implications of all these banks combining to do this at his insistence. And he was rendered virtually incoherent, I'm told. I didn't watch it, but I'm told he was rendered virtually incoherent. So I think that's a useful path to pursue. So thank you very much.
Ambassador Gray has to leave us at 8. It is about that time. So, Boyden, thank you for joining us, fitting us into your busy schedule.
Well, thank you, Judge. Thank you, Judge.
We are running a little bit late, but I would like to give our remaining panelists an opportunity to respond to anything you've heard. Please try to limit rebuttal time to 2 minutes. So, Matt, anything?
I mean, I guess I would make two observations. So, one, there seems to be a general historical suspicion of government power and overreach and competence, all of which I am very sympathetic to. But on the other hand, there's a sort of new fear of these private actors that are pursuing policies that are governing in nature, and they're social or otherwise. And I think those there's a sort of an attempt to conflate those two problems. So, you know, sort of saying, well, the SEC shouldn't be helping BlackRock to pursue its particular goals. But if the SEC weren't doing that, BlackRock would still probably be engaging in this sort of governing power. And who's going to stop them, right? If you fundamentally don't believe that the government has capacity to structure markets, then how are you going to address these private governments? And I think that's sort of one, the one piece that I'd say. And the other piece, and I'd talk about and the ambassador, since he's gone and can't respond.
Go ahead.
All right. Don't tell anyone I said that. Don't tell him I said this. No, I mean, he said antitrust is something to start to look at. But, you know, antitrust has been enfeebled over the last 30 to 40 years. And, you know, just to give you a couple of just one fact, there's been investigations of Google and Facebook probably since 2018, 2019. They're not even going to go to the antitrust cases are not even going to go to trial until 2023, 2024. You're talking about appeals that are going to go up in 2026. So is this really, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this. Fundamentally, it's the same ideology that defanged antitrust, that this deep skepticism of public institutions. So I think that's an area of tension that I think as you confront these problems, you're going to continue to see. And I'd be curious to hear how you think about that.
Excellent. So in terms of the fact that, yes, of course, even without having the SEC in its corner, the Troika is very powerful. But I would point out to you that we can look at this most recent SEC proposing release as solving a collective action problem for these firms, right? So that's why having the government joining with big business, with big finance, can be so dangerous. And I certainly don't mean to oversimplify anything. I mean, in the progressive era, we saw that many reformers thought of the solution to concentrated private power was a more vigorous government, a government that did not necessarily respect constitutional separation of powers considerations and things like that. Now, in the early 21st century, though, I think we see that big government is very often not a good solution to private concentration. It can even exacerbate it. Again, I do not mean to oversimplify. In terms of antitrust, sure, antitrust has sometimes fallen short of its promise, fallen short of the mark, but it remains a powerful, powerful intellectual framework, one dating back to, yes, even before the founding era, with the suspicion of monopolies. There are many legal tools that have been developed over the centuries for grappling with monopolies. Are they completely satisfactory? Of course not, but they're there. And the fact that some things fell into disuse and were not used to their maximum effect for a couple of decades, I don't think should discourage you. And then I just have one question for my co-panelist, Professor Skinner. I just want to ask you the devil's advocate question. I'm sympathetic to your arguments, and I've made similar arguments to a number of people and a number of my liberal friends. And one rejoinder that I get is, well, with modern information technologies, government can be so much more effective at central planning. And I wonder what your reaction is.
Indeed.
Right, exactly. And this might not. Yes, of course, that can be a problem too. But that is one thing that I've heard. Anyway.
Yes. No, thank you. No, thank you for the question and the opportunity to respond. I mean, on the you know, invitation for rebuttal, I don't think I have anything in particular, or on the antitrust issue, I did sort of want to reaffirm and highlight one thing that Professor Mahoney mentioned about passive funds in particular, which sort of, I think, connects to the message that I was trying to deliver. And in particular, in regard to passive funds, I think there is something so deeply threatening to the property rights of one kind of investor, the retail investor, and there's such deprivation of economic choice, because one way to think about what the choice to invest in a passive fund is an ex ante decision on the part of investors to pursue this purely neutral stance, right? And I think that point is even more acute when you think about how much the market has developed so many ESG-specific products. There's such an array of menu options now for investors to specifically choose, right, to commit their resources to a cause, that by choosing a passive fund, you know, you are choosing a market-neutral approach because you would prefer the cost savings and the profits in lieu of this social choice. So I think to sort of assume the power to exercise that voice by managers is really sort of troubling on many levels, and so I wanted to really highlight that point as well. And then to answer your question, you know, I think I would say yes, exactly, and that is perhaps further cause to be concerned. I mean, the government has developed the capacity, right, to not only regulate with the breadth of the administrative state, but to continue to innovate new tools and to frame them in new ways, that we're here debating things that I think would have been completely off the table, you know, 5 or 7 years ago. And so I think the fact that the government has gotten more effective at central planning only creates further pressure on economic liberties that we should continue to push back against before it's too late to really sort of arrest the drift into top-down approaches.
We'll go to Q&A in a minute. I don't know, Alita or Evelyn, is there going to be a mic going around, or how should we just recognize folks? Well, I don't see a mic, so I'll recognize folks in a minute, but let me just pose one question. You took the antitrust. Antitrust was going to be my first one, which is, it seems like a lot of what's going on here is a kind of monopoly leveraging, and to what extent can antitrust law constrain these folks? And I guess we have one not so much and one maybe. Julia, if the root cause of a lot of this is a conflict of interest between the managers and the owners, to what extent can just old-style background corporate law police that and control it?
Oh, I think not just corporate law, but many areas of law have enormous promise, and Ambassador Boyden is a co-author of an excellent white paper on exactly this topic. The difficulty is that in many of these doctrines are uncertain. Oh, sorry, many of these doctrines are uncertain. It can take time. So I'm expressing confidence that the rule of law can address the conflicts of interest that I have detailed, but I don't want to be over-optimistic about how quickly this can happen and how fully those who have been not treated properly by those to whom they entrusted their money can be compensated. The law is, I think, effective, but it is highly imperfect. And when we think about losses of money, of retail investors particularly, we recognize that our legal system is not designed to and cannot likely be designed to make everyone who has suffered real losses whole in reasonable time.
We have about 20 minutes for questions.
Sure. Do you mind if I just want to mention
that? No, go ahead.
I do think antitrust is an important part of the solution, but I just wanted to clarify that. What I think has happened is the case law has undermined the ability to prevent these kinds of concentrations of power. That's sort of what I was hitting at. And in particular, the insertion of efficiency as the lodestar of antitrust, the consumer welfare standard, is why you couldn't use it to address the troika. They would say, well, we're just more efficient, therefore, what are you complaining about? And things like monopoly leveraging wouldn't work.
So that's kind of... think the concept of predatory conduct for a Section 2 claim is flexible enough to cover any of this?
Well, it sort of more matters what you think on that, but...
All right, fair enough.
But I think this is I think that the courts have gone way too far to basically get rid of antitrust law. There hasn't, there's a reason there wasn't a Section 2 claim from the Department of Justice from Microsoft in 1998 to Google in 2020, right? This is a crisis, right? And Congress should step in, but the courts also have to step in. I mean, there is a reason we have these private governments. It's because antitrust law has turned into a dead letter, and it shouldn't be.
Okay, let's go to Q&A. I'm just going to ask, when we recognize you, since we don't have a mic, please stand up and speak loudly. Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you very much for the presentation. I appreciate it. I have one question for Professor Skinner. I might have missed it, but I know your presentation largely focused on the state versus or free market versus the command economy, but what happens when the free market is sort of absurd through pursuing these extra, if you will, extra profitable goals, right? When they go for environmental policies and other things, that's what we call the Paris state. What happens then? Do you have a distorted market? And how do you then deal with the incentives in that space aside from the
government? Can you just rephrase the speak the question into the microphone?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to rephrase.
Work the question into the answer.
Sure, sure. So I think your question is essentially stating many of the concerns that Professor Mahoney has raised, and Matt Stoller as well, in terms of their captured special interest or conflicts of interest, right? So free markets work well enough until we introduce what I refer to as noise in the background, right? Do we really know that this is a free market solution, or is there some special interest or conflict of interest at heart? And I mean, that is essentially when you need to rely on guardrails in the legal system. So I hate to deliver the same, you know, answer that was just given, but I think you would look to existing legislation or to Congress to rein in excesses. Now, the problem then is, well, what can we expect from the courts and other contexts? So I think a lot about central banks, for example. There are frequently situations where either no party has standing or incentive to access the courts to challenge this behavior, right? So if you think about retail investors, for example, they may not have sufficient incentive to really care enough, right, to motivate themselves to challenge these actions and pursue conflict of interest cases or anything else under the securities law. And the same thing comes up in other contexts in bank regulation. Individual shareholders, you know, may not feel like they need to push back. So it's a little bit like who will push back against some of the excesses. And I think it's a combination of sort of airing these public debates, right, so that we have conversations like this, suggesting that there is a significant segment of society that perceives some of the institutional or sort of executive and manager's actions as self-interested, and to shine a light on that, right? And then we start to think about whether there are other legislative backstops that might be required.
Yes, and I would just add to that that for the retail investors who might not have a sufficient interest, well, the SEC is supposed to be,
exactly,
in effect, looking out for them. I think that conversations like this are extremely useful in terms of having extensive and public discussions about what the institutional roles are of our various government components.
There were some other hands. Yes.
I'd like to ask Professor, there you go. Excellent. Thank you, miss. My question is, the last time I talked to John Kenneth Galbraith, he was very sure that the United States and the Soviet Union were going to the same place. And he was also very sure, more sure than I think anyone I've ever met, that people like him were going to run everything forever. He just had that sense, and he told me directly. So one of the problems that I have, because I thought your presentation was absolutely right about the large entities and the private law, is this. All of the large entities, when I last talked to John Kenneth Galbraith, are gone and not at the top of the heap anymore. And I don't know that BlackRock will be at the top of the heap in 10 years, or Facebook will, or any. But if we give the power to the agency, it'll be here because they don't die. And if they make mistakes, it doesn't wipe them out. Whereas BlackRock can make a mistake and it's gone, and it's suddenly no one ever talks about it anymore. So my concern is, I think you're really on point on a lot of what you said about the concerns of the concentrated power. But all of those private groups that were there when I was talking to Galbraith are not powerful anymore, but all of the agencies still are.
Any comments?
Oh, that was for me.
Whoever.
You know. Oh, whoever. You guys both mentioned Galbraith. I have a lot of respect for Galbraith. He was a courageous man, a beautiful writer. I don't agree with his economic philosophy and convergence theory, the Soviet Union. I was reading that, I was like, this is crazy, right? This is crazy stuff, you know? And he didn't really believe that man had any role in his, he said the power of, I don't have the quote on me, but basically said that we can't decide the nature of our economic system, right? It's inevitable, and we have no agency. So there's sort of a hint of a kind of an anti-democratic view there, just the inevitable
the inevitability of everything that happens. And I guess when you talk about, you know, nothing lasts forever, right? And we know that, no empire lasts forever. But one of the things that, you know, I think there's always been this concern since the founding about monopoly charters and private concentrated power, because even though you're not there forever, if you have dominant power, you can cause a lot of harm as long as you're on top, if you can use your power in an unfair way or coercive way. And that is something that, you know, checks and balances in the government, you know, the way that we thought about that in the commercial sphere was through competition. And one of the reasons that you haven't seen, say Microsoft lead Web 2.0 is because Microsoft wasn't allowed to lead it because of an antitrust suit. And one of the reasons AMP fell is because of a series of antitrust suits. And it's because of political choices. We made political choices. We've always made political choices to structure our markets. And we've traditionally made those political choices to ensure that not only could nobody stay on top for too long, but nobody could be coercive or abusive with the market power that they had. And we stopped making those choices in the 1980s, 1990s. And because of that, you know, you've seen tremendous consolidation. There aren't even, I think it's the Wilshire 5000, there are not even 5,000 public companies anymore because of mergers. So, you know, companies are bigger, they're older today than they've ever been. We really have a highly consolidated economic order, even if, you know, everybody falls eventually. They could do a lot of damage in the meantime. I think that's what we're seeing now.
Thank you. So much of the discussion is focused around economics, but what if 21st century's man's biggest problems are not economic, as in we have so much stuff, we have so much trinkets, and I'm not denying that there aren't billions of very poor people in the world, but in the United States, I've been amazed to see, you know, lower middle class people with dozens of pairs of $300 sneakers, and they go on luxury cruises and eat like the kings of, you know, the 18th century or whatever. They might not live in a nice area, they might have a lot of debt, but they're wearing a $30,000 watch. So Larry Fink certainly doesn't need any more money. And so this just leads me to think that, you know, certainly the pursuit of efficiency and productivity is, I'm 100% on board with that. But how can you explain societal changes and the pursuit of power, I think, by people that are pushing the woke or the ESG agenda? Will money alone solve it? Or do you also have to understand people and sort of not just the monetary or physical capital, but social capital, sort of more intrinsic or inexplicable utility that people gain through identifying with various things or movements? And isn't that really the kind of where we're maybe losing to the other side, if there is another side?
I think that all the factors and considerations that you just mentioned are very important. What is, I think, very important, absolutely key when it comes to institutional design, is to ensure that to the extent that people wish to pursue goals other than the financial, which I, of course, very much applaud, they are not able to do so on someone else's dime. So I have absolutely no objection to those who wish to pursue forms of ESG investing if they are internalizing all the costs of it. If people decide that they wish to invest in funds that advertise themselves as ESG is environmentally sensitive, as not having conflict minerals, as not doing this, not doing that, only fair trade and so forth, I think that is terrific, but it is absolutely crucial that those who make the decision to invest that way also shoulder any of the downside. And that is the, I think, huge issue with ESG.
No, nothing to add. Excellent. I agree with everything you just said in terms of, I think I made the point earlier also about passive funds and choice. So
exactly.
Well said.
Yes.
Hi. I guess my question is, if the consumer welfare standard has not prevented or corrected the excesses of ESG investing, what public policy framework has a better chance at protecting the commitment to shareholders? And an addendum to that is the return to financial shareholder primacy the appropriate goal? Thank you.
So, Matt, if not consumer welfare, what was so wrong with consumer welfare, and where do we go now?
I only want to talk about Galbraith, so only John Kenneth Galbraith-related questions from now on, please. I think that you guys have done a lot of great writing on the problem of shareholder primacy and how it. Let me start by saying I think any financial system is inherently political. Like we have chosen to create a system where it is easier to put your money into corporations that are really far away as opposed to your local restaurant. Or, you know, I cannot easily recycle my savings into local businesses around me, even if I wanted to. It'd be very difficult to. That's a political choice, right? It's not a choice about, there is no neutrality here. We just choose in the structure of our systems what we are going to incentivize as a society. We make those collective choices. So I think, when you've talked about, so shareholder primacy creates a situation where we are essentially anti-production in our economy. And we have offshored huge amounts of productive capacity when I think we're seeing the dangers of that right now with supply chains and COVID and whatnot. When you focus on efficiency, you lose resiliency. You lose certain forms of innovation. You lose community. And you can just see towns all over this country whose heart has been ripped out when the factory went abroad. Maybe that was efficient, maybe it wasn't, but there are other values at stake. So, I think if you, consumer welfare is a particular vision of how to organize antitrust. I prefer to think about rivalry. So are there rivals in a market versus is a market efficient as determined by these moral reformers that we call economists? Like, I think it's easier to say how many companies are there in the market, and if you can count them on your hand, there's probably not enough, right? That's much simpler, much more administrable. It doesn't require our fancy people to calculate and hide their political assumptions in models, which I think is very dangerous and encourages big government, big business, and the rest of it. So that's what I would focus on, is really simple rules, thresholds, like you can't have more than X percent of a market. BlackRock, I believe they own Aladdin, which is a bond trading platform. Like, they can't, just split that off. No man may serve two masters, right? Just go through the economy, make very simple rules, like stop signs. That's the easiest way to admit. No one ever paid off a stop sign. Right, that's the way to, so simple stuff, right? That simple administrative rules to keep markets decentralized.
Question in the back there.
Thank you. For Professor Mahoney on the BlackRock Vanguard and State Street problem, there was a famous case in California involving the teachers' unions where the Supreme Court said members of the union had a right to get a rebate for the portion of their dues that were being used for political speech. Now, voting a proxy never used to be a political act. I think if you brought it before the court now and looked at all the quotas and reverse discrimination and all of the agenda items now, it would be considered a political act. I wonder if that could be a framework. As we know, investors cannot sell out of their fund because they'll incur capital gains tax. IT makes things possible that never were possible before. Could it be a framework that you just require the funds, especially the index funds, to provide the option to shareholders to say, don't vote my shares other than for quorum purposes, and by the way, rebate whatever the cost is. There is an obvious free rider problem there, but the Supreme Court did not accept that with respect to the teachers' unions. So that could be the way forward as soon as we have the political power to force them to do that.
Yes, thanks for raising that. That's a great point. There is one exciting development in this area is an increased interest in pass-through voting. A number of people, experts and so forth, are looking carefully, more carefully than in recent years at the benefits of pass-through voting for exactly these reasons.
The mic has been passed, I see, so go ahead.
So a lot of the discussion this evening has focused on the economic implications of ESG, but we are, of course, here for the Freedom of Thought Project. And I wonder if any of you have any commentary on what the ESG movement is doing to our public square and how it is impacting freedom of thought and the debates that are going on around these issues, because it seems to me that ESG has actually become a euphemism for certain forms of thought and certain political beliefs, and that there really isn't actually now a broader set of debates and questioning of certain of these dogma. And I'm just curious, on our theme here, freedom of thought, is the ESG movement in some ways undermining our public square and our public debate?
Yeah, so I'm happy to take that one. I think that much of the ESG conversation to date has been highly polarizing in some ways for precisely this reason, because in places of the public square, in academia, or in corporate settings, there is sort of one accepted position to take on the merits or the value or the approach to ESG. And that tends to be along the lines of what we were focusing on in our remarks today in terms of pushing banks toward net zero policies, in terms of pushing portfolio companies to green their business models, in terms of pushing regulators to work alongside and provide some tailwinds to these goals. And I think that can be very alienating for those who in academia or the corporate life would perhaps take a more nuanced view. For example, I think the question has been raised a few times this evening about, well, how can shareholders be better protected? What can we do to protect shareholders who may not share these particular views but are powerless? And, you know, going back to first principles, one of the basic ways that we protect shareholders is by thinking about the fiduciary duties that managers and board members owe to shareholders. And for many years, that was framed around the shareholder wealth maximization principle. And as part and parcel of the ESG conversation, it's been assumed that wealth maximization is inconsistent with these other goals. And the desire to have more wide-ranging debate about how wealth maximization can be consistent with, or in fact reinforced by, some of the sort of other goals that would be incorporated into ESG, sort of why firms that take a longer-term view may also be wealth maximizing, right? That has been the kind of conversation that has not been consistent with many of the sort of on-brand ESG conversations. So I think that it is fair to say that public discussion around these issues has been stifled. You know, a second example that just came to mind, and the point was raised in an earlier panel, which I agree with entirely, is that we are so focused on the E and to some extent the S, and not so much the G. You know, the G has sort of, governance has been framed, it's sort of as a bootstrap or a way of facilitating or implementing the E and the S policies, right? But we haven't really thought about how certain kinds of governance goals might sort of even work in opposite directions, and how do we order conflicts and trade-offs between the E and the S and the G? And that would be more of a fair and balanced conversation, but that isn't exactly always the conversation that we're having.
It's now 8:30. I gather you need to go now. The panelists are dropping like flies. some of us will be around for longer. Alita, can we keep going a little bit on the more public Q&A? All right, go ahead.
Sure. Another free speech question. I think it's clear that at this point in the law, the actors that we're talking about, you know, be it BlackRock, banks, tech companies, are not state actors and are not covered by the First Amendment. Not everyone would agree with me there, but That view is certainly in conflict with what a lot of people on both the right and left want to do, which is regulate the speech of a lot of these actors. I mean, especially the platforms and content moderation. And again, I think right now, you know, I think you would have a solid majority on the court not to go in that direction. But the Supreme Court, you know, may not bend when there's pressure from one side, but, you know, both sides, I sort of fear that over the coming decades, First Amendment law, state actor doctrine will sort of evolve to take into account, again, the pressure and maybe the new reality of technology. What are your thoughts on that?
Let's just thank Christina.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Do you have any thoughts?
I mean, I think, so I look at the, I think one way to understand the problem of the public square and free speech is sort of as a, it's both a question of who can say what, but it's also a question of who can be in what spaces. And one of the things that I think we've seen as you've seen more and more consolidation in sort of across the board, not, you know, big tech, entertainment, banking, asset management, is the shrinking of space for free expression. And that's not a question of sort of censorship per se, right? Someone saying, you can't say this, you can't say that. It's just there's just not a lot of newspapers anymore because that ad money has been sucked up by two companies. And so there's just not many forums for doing journalism. There's just a few newspapers, right? And everyone in journalism is, they're, you know, there's the pressure there to conform to certain ways of thinking is intense. But that's because the consolidation has meant that there are very few opportunities outside of that. You see that across industries. So I guess I think about it in the 19th century, I think that the post office was a much more important institution. It was the way that people thought about organizing free expression rather than the First Amendment, which I think a lot of the First Amendment doctrine that we talk about today comes out of the mid-century having, you know, three TV networks and newspapers and Pentagon Papers and all that. But I think we're returning to an older era where it's sort of a question of how do you design public spaces and network systems so that there is space for free expression. And I'm not, I'm not an expert in this doctrine, but I think that's where I'd be looking, right? More than that's why I'm so interested in antitrust and less in sort of traditional questions of the First Amendment.
Yeah, so I'll be more optimistic. I actually think that we have been going through some growing pains. The internet, I think, is a fabulous technology, but no question that it's been a disruptive technology. But so was the printing press. And it seems that to me that there is a great thirst for substantive discussion, a lot of respect for First Amendment principles, even among private actors. You look at universities, it's not just public universities that that are taking in response to a great deal of publicly expressed concern and so forth. It's not just public universities that are looking very, very carefully at what they can do to facilitate open, substantive discussion that takes into account a range of views. It is not just the same old orthodoxy. And I think Twitter looks like it's going to improve significantly, but there was already a lot of excellent, excellent stuff on Twitter. You had to avoid a lot of scabrous stuff, but that's always been true in the
Never go on Twitter.
Never go on Twitter. I'm not saying it's not a cesspool, but I will say in terms of distributing ideas, it's turned into a very powerful force. Twitter is not alone. And so I think going forward, we are, as a society, figuring out how to have more substantive discussion and that, well, no one can predict the future, that actually things are looking up.
I've been told I have to end the official part of the program, so please join me in thanking our remaining panelists.
much for joining us tonight. Appreciate all of the programs today and for a really fantastic panel to close it out. And we're adjourned.